That is a component here, Joe. All right.
Good afternoon. We're going to open the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources today. And we have a few people in the audience, and I have a feeling we're going to have a good conversation going on for the dealing with today's agenda. So thank you for being here, and we will begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you do have the Department of Agriculture here today. They'll be here for 3 days, with the third day, Wednesday, we're trying to hold for public testimony so folks can testify on their budget. The department has a wide variety of programs that they've been responsible for that you'll hear about in the next few days. I just wanted to clear up one thing that was a little bit of confusion in one of my write-ups about the shellfish testing. There was some additional money available last biennium in addition to the base budget the department has for shellfish testing, and that was related to more of the industrial side of the shellfish production, and that one-time money was phased out. So I wrote that the governor's budget didn't include any general fund, but what I meant to say was any additional general fund. There's still some general fund in the base budget for shellfish testing for the industrial areas. There's also, of course, money in that budget from testing from the shellfish license fees. Shellfish license fees go to ag for testing, they go to OSP for enforcement, and they go to ODF&W for resource enhancement.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we're going to have more conversation about that as well. So I guess we should call up the folks from the Department of Agriculture. You should be able to find the presentation is also on OLIS.
Yep.
So if you need to look at that, or if you want to just look at the screen, that's fine too. Please introduce yourselves and go right ahead.
Great. Well, thank you, Chairman Frederick, for having us here today. My name is Alexis Taylor. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me today, I have Lisa Hansen, the deputy director, and Lauren Henderson, the assistant director, as well as, Kathleen Conley with DAS. This is my fifth week on the job, so I look forward to discussing what we do at ODA, but also appreciate a little bit of patience. That's why you have the A-team with me here today, to make sure we are able to accurately answer all of the committee's questions you may have. It's been a busy 5 weeks since I've been on the job, and I've been, last week we had the Board of Ag in town for our quarterly meeting. The week before that, I was over in Malheur County surveying some of the damage from the recent winter storms. My second week on the job, I went back to DC to participate in the National Association of the State Departments of Agriculture's annual meeting. So it's been a busy 5 weeks all along while preparing for this committee hearing. I'm not going to necessarily read through slides word for word, but talk about some of the context behind them. So please ask any questions you may have if there's something that is not hit. I would say first and foremost, you know, one of the big take-home messages is ODA is really a unique agency in Oregon state government. We regulate, but we also promote Oregon agricultural products. That can sometimes create a tension, but I think that tension really helps and pushes us at ODA to really be thoughtful about how we regulate, why we regulate, and work for workable solutions for the people we regulate. Our culture is one of compliance. It is a strategic goal for us. We want our stakeholders to have the tools necessary to be able to do the right thing in order to comply with the laws, the statutes, our rules and regulations that we have. But also, we have that regulatory backstop that is important in that culture of compliance if and when we interact with someone who is not able or unwilling to comply with the law or the regulations. We don't necessarily base our success on the number of civil penalties we issue. We really base our success on being able to work hand in glove with the people we regulate on the ground. We also try to be a nimble organization. You're going to hear this over the next day or two, highlight a couple examples of where we try to be flexible, be nimble, and adapt as Oregon agriculture adapts. consumers want options in the type of food they buy. Producers want options in what they grow and how they grow it. And ODA really tries to work to give both those consumers and those producers the options they need. In order to really achieve our mission at ODA, we need long-term stable funding for success. I think one example of that that you will hear today and tomorrow is around the Japanese beetle eradication that we're going to hopefully be undertaking over the course of the next 5 years up in Northwest Portland area. One other thing I would just mention is we really rely on key partnerships to help us carry out our core mission at ODA. And what is our core mission? Our core mission is threefold, which you see here. I think all of our programs that we're going to talk about revolve around this threefold mission. First and foremost, though, our number one priority of our core mission is food safety. It touches every single Oregonian. We are developing or working to develop a new agency strategic plan. It's in the works, and we will talk more about that, but we are targeting this fall for completion. You know, one thing Oregon Ag has changed a lot since our current strategic plan was created maybe 13 or 14 years ago, and Oregon agriculture will probably continue to evolve in the next 10, 20, 25 years. And so making sure our strategic plan, our goals along with that are evolving with Oregon agriculture. It is something also the Board of Agriculture is very focused on. This slide just talks a little bit about who and what Oregon agriculture is and who ODA serves and regulates. 95% of Oregon farms and ranches are family-owned and operated. Oregon is one of the most diverse states in the United States for the types of crops and number of crops we grow. We grow over 225. That diversity is certainly a strength and a huge opportunity, but it also can be a challenge. That diversity also means coexistence. That is something you're going to hear a lot about as we talk through a whole host of our program areas, and that can be coexistence in the environment, urban versus rural Oregon, in between really the diversity of crops being grown. Agriculture is also a very important economic driver for the state of Oregon. It represents about 15% of the state's GDP is tied to agriculture. Here, I think a picture is worth a thousand words, and it really talks about shows the diversity that I just mentioned of Oregon crops, and these are the top 20 by value. Oregon farmers and ranchers are extremely productive, and we produce a lot more than what we are going to be able to consume here in the state. A lot of what we produce, a lot of what's on this top 20 is being exported outside of the state, about 80%, and about 40 to 50% is actually being sent internationally. I think it's also interesting to just point out a lot of in our top 20 are things we actually don't eat. A lot of these things are probably in all our refrigerators right now today or in our pantries, but a lot of the commodities and crops like Christmas trees, hay, nursery crops, grass seed are things we actually aren't eating, but they are very important economic drivers for agriculture in the state. Next, we're going to go into our program areas. We are organized under five program areas at ODA, and we're really structured this way to try and maximize efficiency to ensure food safety, protect the natural resource base, and maintain and expand markets for our products. Here is our working organizational chart. It is headed by myself, the director. We have a policy board, the Board of Agriculture, which helps and advises us. We have the deputy director and assistant director, and then in our office, we really serve as the coordinating feature for many natural resources cross-cutting issues for cannabis, but also then all of the kind of administrative services are housed under the director's office as well. We have then broken up into five program areas. These five program areas cover 36 programs. The department administers. We actually have 34 main statutes which govern and direct our duties and responsibilities. We administer over 35 different license types, which issue over 40,000 licenses every year. I think it's really interesting when you talk about diversity of Oregon agriculture. I think that diversity is actually highlighted in the breadth and depth of the programs we have at ODA. again, a picture is worth a thousand words here. This is just a little bit of a snapshot of where we are across the state in ODA's footprints. One of the things that really struck me when I saw this, being new to the department, is, you know, ODA is in the communities we serve. And that's a huge benefit to us. We are, our staff out in the field are our eyes and ears. They can really talk to us about what's going on in the community. I've seen that firsthand my first 5 weeks on the job with what's going on in Eastern Oregon with Malheur County and what those, you know, the onion producers are experiencing. Our folks in the field have been able to really talk to us about what it means to those communities. We also, where we can put cross-program staff together, we are also co-located with other agencies where that makes sense around the state. We are considering a regional office in maybe some areas if that makes sense. But a lot of our staff out in the field are working from their homes, and that helps control cost. The first program, we'll go through the five program areas, and we're going to go through them the order of the organizational chart, not necessarily, priority order. First up is market access and certification program services. We really look at market access as a three-legged stool. There's the local markets, the regional or domestic markets, and then the international markets. I would say these are all interconnected and are all equally important to Oregon agriculture, no matter what size of farmer or farm operation you have. The main objective of this program area is to increase economic activity in agriculture and really the communities that they're based in. So here are listed our program goals. While the primary purpose of this program area is to help the private sector in crafting and creating markets for Oregon products, we also have a really underlying goal to expand the understanding about an industry that really contributes so much to Oregon's economy. A lot of jobs are tied to agriculture, but sometimes people often don't think of them as ag jobs, whether it's the truck driver transporting produce to local markets or someone processing, those apples into applesauce. You know, those jobs are tied to ag, and if farmers weren't growing those commodities in the field, those jobs wouldn't exist. So I think it's an important nexus to be able to explain to the general public as well. This program area and our staff in it do a lot of technical work that most people never see or don't even know we do. We do inspections, certifications, audits, and of all kinds of products that move into the marketplace. The first leg of our stool is the local market. The local, food movement's been sweeping the country and is really a catchphrase, but I think before it was a catchphrase, it's been really a staple of Oregon agriculture for a long time. And Oregon has definitely been a leader in this. You can see it a lot of different ways in the state. Being new to the state, I think it's really cool that we have local food trucks in the Portland airport. I think that really speaks to how much people in Oregon appreciate that local food and being able to connect to growers around their communities. We are focused on providing more opportunity for small farmers to access larger and regional markets. Delivering distribution is a big challenge for those smaller producers, and ODA is working with a whole host of other partners really to try and tackle some of those challenges. We can certainly go into any more detail on some of the products that are some of the programs that are on this slide, but one I really wanted to highlight is the Celebrate Oregon Agriculture campaign. This campaign really provides an opportunity for ODA and the ag community to really partner with some local media to raise the profile of Oregon agriculture. It really was, the first features were kind of focused around educating the public on how to access local foods, grow foods in their garden, and then really, take that food and with their kids or, with their families, make something with it for them to eat. But I think that there also is a connection to that general public on how food is grown. 150 years ago, when Oregon was just becoming a state, 90% of the country, of the population in the entire United States, lived in rural areas. Today, 10% does. We are more generations removed from agriculture, from how our food's produced today, than we ever have been. And drawing that connection, I think, is really important to what the people who are growing our food every day do, and making sure that people know that that gallon of milk doesn't actually come from the grocery store. It comes from a dairy farmer. And there are a lot of steps in the process to get it to that grocery store. The next leg of the stool is the domestic market or the regional markets. I think there sometimes there's a progression for farmers, ranchers, and agribusinesses. They start out at a local market, they can move into the domestic market, maybe they move in eventually to the international market. And we want our programs to be able to support them doing that. Now, not everybody wants that, not every agribusiness wants that, and that's fine, and we want our programs to support them at the stage they're at or the stage they want to be at. You can see from the slides a few of the domestic marketing opportunities we have taken over this over the past year or two. One thing we do focus on is trade shows, or individually we work with companies kind of one-on-one. I think foundational is the companies we work with, making sure they maintain the markets they're in, expand to new markets if they would like, and then eventually, you know, also recruit new companies who are interested in either in starting up and getting into a local market or expanding from one of those three categories. Next in leg of the stool is the international market. ODA does have a governmental status that's recognized by foreign governments, so we're able to really be a resource to help resolve trade barriers, particularly non-tariff barriers when one arises. You know, one example of this is if an exporter finds a pest, and we're able to actively work with that foreign government and help hopefully identify, was it a pest, was it an invasive pest, and work through some of that. And this definitely intersects with some of our other program areas we will talk about later on. We also do a lot of work around trade missions and trade shows, again, really connecting our buyers in international markets to sellers here in Oregon, and being able to make that connection, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. I would just say I think the international market program that we run is really important, and it's a long-term investment. I think those relationships, particularly when you're looking at Asia, are vital to being able to be in those markets, stay in those markets. And no matter everything we do here in Oregon, people around the other, someone else in the world is doing it, whether it's beef from Australia, cheese from New Zealand, pears from Poland. We have competitors, so the investment that we're making here is really important to maintaining a competitive advantage. We do leverage our resources at the state with federal dollars here through our state and regional trade association, USADA. We also do a host of inspections, audits, and certifications. Some are mandatory to be able to sell products outside of the state. Others are voluntary, like the National Organic Program, which we run. This program really we look at what market demand is, what are what companies are asking for, and we help work to develop and provide, whether it's product sampling and testing, to make sure they can get into that market to meet buyer specifications or even sometimes government specifications. We also administer the hemp program, which I think is an example, again, of ODA really trying to be that nimble organization that I mentioned earlier. We're in the third year of that and continue to learn what needs to be done to meet the industry needs. And so we're continually working with the industry to try and evolve to make sure our rules and regulations allow them to market their product. Next up is our food safety and animal health program services. As I mentioned earlier, food safety is our number one priority in the agency, and it really is the one program that touches every single Oregonian. Our food safety and animal health program provide 43 types of licenses to over 4,000 licensees around the state. We inspect food safety establishments under a risk-based model. For the most part, assessments don't necessarily have a time-specific frame in mind, but we organize them based upon the establishments that are higher risk. So some maybe establishments ever see us every year and a half or so. There are a couple exceptions to this, which I'll talk about in a couple slides. For instance, a chain retail store maybe has their own food safety staff. We'd probably see them less often unless there's a problem. You know, I think under this, some of what we do is particularly at the chain retail stores or kind of common sense, you know, keep hot foods hot, cold foods cold, meat separated from fruit and vegetables, those types of things. But it is so vital to make sure that we have that safe, wholesome food supply. So I think it's important to actually highlight the one of the main goals is to prevent, control, and eliminate diseases harmful to livestock, poultry, and humans. I think one question we get sometimes is why livestock and poultry? Why not, you know, why is that under here, under the food safety? And I think it's, you know, they're really interconnected. Having a healthy livestock and poultry population in the state is vital to having healthy humans. There are certain animal diseases, which we're lucky we don't have right now, that are transmittable to humans. So really, they are interrelated, and that's why they are housed together. It's also, I think, very important, one of the program goals, having healthy, safe food products and healthy livestock and poultry helps protect markets. And I can talk about an example on the next slide on, or next two slides, when where we saw some impacts from that. So who do we regulate? ODA regulates everything except restaurants when it comes to food. We regulate all food processors and the majority of food retailers. The Oregon Health Authority regulates some food retailers, and we actually coordinate so we're not duplicating our efforts there. You know, one way, it's really based around sales at the deli counter. So if 50%, over 50% of the sales come from the deli counter, OHA regulates them, under 50, ODA regulates them. But I think the important piece there is we have adopted the same food code, so we're operating under the same sets of rules, which is really important, I think, for the businesses to see that same consistency, know what the rules are of the road. We also work really hard to provide technical assistance on the front end for startup food companies. It's, you know, much better for them to come to us, learn what the rules, requirements are, and be able to build to that, whether it's like a new commercial kitchen or what have you, and build to that, then come to us after they invested all of that time and money just to realize they made a mistake or they need to adapt. So we spend a lot of time working with new food companies, new food startups on technical assistance on what standard they are going to need to meet. And then we also coordinate closely with FDA and the Oregon Health Authority. Again, if there is a foodborne illness that requires a recall, we work to get foods off the grocery, off the shelves and out of the grocery store. As I said earlier, we follow a risk-based model with two exceptions. We do all the surveillance and testing on dairy products, and this is done more regularly to really meet federal requirements for the Interstate Milk Shipment Compact, or Shippers Compact. In order to sell milk and dairy products across state lines, they need to be inspected and tested more frequently. Also with shellfish is the other commodity that testing is required for interstate shipping, and ODA is responsible for that. On FSMA, we have, which is the Food Safety Modernization Act. It was passed several years ago, and it's really been the first major overhaul of our food safety program in over 50 years, probably. And ODA has spent a lot of time around what those new rules are, figuring out how we're going to be implementing some of them, and working right now, we focused with producers on education and outreach, on what, and with extension, on what those new standards are going to have to be that they're going to meet. Now, not all of them are done from FDA, so I think there's still some confusion on what exactly is going to be required of our fruit and vegetable growers and some of the new processors, but we're working through some of that. I do think an ongoing question is going to be around funding, on funding around FSMA, and that's going to be, I think, an ongoing challenge. Finally, I did just want to mention that food safety programs do touch cannabis. We are responsible for sanitation criteria for cannabis companies, and we have 287 cannabis food safety licensees currently. We recently, the Secretary of State recently released an audit around our food safety programs, and I want to talk briefly about the results and how we are tackling that. But I think first and foremost, it's important to mention that we have safe food here in here in Oregon. We explicitly asked that of the auditors, and they were clear up front that our food safety in the state is not in question. The Secretary of State conducted an audit of our food safety program in 2016. I think we welcomed it, and we actually have found it very helpful. The food safety program has had relatively new management team, and the managers really appreciated the opportunity for an outside assessment. I think we knew going in we had a backlog. We did not know the extent of the backlog. And I think the audit had really helped us identify some systemic problems that we needed to address. You know, it's not just about throwing more staff resources to get rid of the backlog. If you don't address some of the underlying systemic problems that were going on, we would be in this position again. I think it's also important to note that we're looking at, you know, really addressing the systemic problems to reduce that backlog. For example, some of the problems just around data, consistency on how our inspectors in the field were entering data and what it all meant, so bringing some consistency around what those data points really mean. The lack of our ability for our two supervisors to be out in the field or spend enough time out in the field with our inspectors helping them out. The amount of federal contract inspection work we're taking on. I would note that we are in the process of developing a strategic plan to address the items of concern raised by the audit, and that was provided in your budget materials. And we can certainly would be happy to talk through in greater detail any of those points if there's interest.
Excuse me for just a second.
Yes,
I think
sir.
That's part of the appendices, if you want to take a look at that.
Yes, sir. Yes, thank you, Chairman. So as I said earlier, animal health is directly tied to human health, and that's why it's also ranked very highly in this program area within our agency. We track the health and movement of livestock and poultry to try and prevent diseases in the state of Oregon. We want to keep the diseases out, but if we do find one, we want to move quickly to eradicate them, not just from a disease. Health and human health perspective, but also from an economic perspective. This can have huge economic impacts. There is a recent high-profile example of this. In the end of 2015, high-path avian influenza was detected in some backyard flocks in Oregon. Washington State and California both had them in commercial flocks. The strain in Oregon and in the rest of the United States is not transmittable to humans. I think that was an important note, but there are some strains that were. And so again, that's that linkage between animal health and human health. It's also had some big economic impacts for poultry exports. I think 30 countries or more put export bans on poultry products either from Oregon or from the entire United States. The logo you see here on the bottom was part of a outreach campaign to poultry owners regarding avian influenza, about trying to keep your backyard, your birds and wild birds separate. We also have the state vet, our veterinarian is housed in our agency. Our state veterinarian works with local counterparts, federal counterparts, to identify emerging diseases, risks that we might have, and implementing strategies to keep those diseases out of our state. We also have the State of Oregon Animal Health Laboratory System. Part of that is under ODA, the Animal Health Lab located in Salem, and the other part is OSU's Veterinary Diagnostics Lab. The ODA Animal Health Lab conducts really testing of regulatory concerns, like when we had high-path avian influenza here several years ago. OSU's Veterinary Diagnostics Lab conducts testing of really non-regulatory concerns. Also under this is our livestock identification services. You know, it kind of sounds like something from an old Western, but cattle theft, cattle rustling does happen occasionally. And we register 11,000 brands in the state. Part of that is used as a deterrent. from potential theft. But it's also important to really protect those private property rights of those ranchers. In the past 5 years, we've had about 3 large-scale cases where our brand inspectors worked with local law enforcement to build a case. We also take approximately 50 missing livestock reports each year. Last year, that was about 259 head of cattle were represented in those 50 reports. Our brand inspections are also required anytime there's a change of ownership. So at an auction, out-of-state shipment, when livestock's being slaughtered. And I guess we also offer voluntary inspections for horses. Our commercial feed services. This is really about consumer protection, and what's on the label is in the bag. So we just work to ensure people are getting what they're actually buying and paying. Our next program area is the plant protection and conservation programs. I would say, much like animal health, it's about keeping the bad things out and maintaining, really to maintain a healthy Oregon agricultural production and to markets. We also protect the threatened and endangered plants from extinction under this program area. The key principle to success in our plant protection and conservation programs, again, like animal health, is early detection and rapid response. It's really buzzwords you hear around the invasives world, but it's important to maintain pest-free for markets. So there's an economic tie. There's also, I think, an environmental tie, and it's really important to Oregon's ecosystems as well as benefiting really water quality in the state. We focus on early detection. In one biennium, we'll install over 16,000 traps. We're looking for things like gypsy moth, like Japanese beetle, and we put out traps all over the state. We monitor them, and we collect them at the end of the year. We also deal, this program area also deals with noxious weeds. We have the Noxious Weed Board, which maintains a noxious weed list of the 100 worst weeds. They help prioritize program efforts, as well as, you know, we partner with county weed boards, soil and water conservation districts, and a number of nonprofits who do work on the weed side of things. There is a link that I think sometimes isn't talked about, and that's to water quality. If we don't have healthy riparian areas, and they're, you know, full of noxious weeds, they're not doing the things we need them to do to clean and filter the water. So this is one that does cross and touch other program areas. Early detection and rapid response is a kind of tried and true, I think, practice, and really has worked. For example, we had the gypsy moth eradication up in north and northwest Portland last year. We put out approximately 7,000 acres were treated with an aerial application of a biological pesticide to eradicate Asian and European gypsy moth infestations. We also use biological controls. We've released 77 species of biological controls on 31 noxious weed species. One example is this is in 1974, the Oregon legislature provided ODA funding to start a biological control effort on tansy ragwort, which was actually causing over $4 million in economic harm to livestock producers due to tansy ragwort poisoning. So what we have found is successful biological control measures like tansy ragwort really generate a 15-to-1 benefit to cost, I guess, ratio, 1-to-15 cost to benefit ratio. In this current,
excuse me, yes, where are we now in terms of the tansy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. So what we see happening today is the population of tansy ebbing and flowing. And when it goes up, the number of biologicals goes up, they eat them back down, and you see it come back down again. And so it really has become kind of a natural cycle. It's much less than what we saw many years ago.
I'm just curious about the cycle. Is it several years, or how many? I mean, is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? What is that cycle?
Okay, I'm going to look back to Helmut Throg and see if he can give me.
He's waving and going. I'm not sure.
It depends on the weather, climate.
Okay, thank you. Just curious. Thank you. If you haven't seen the, do you know the how that is what the biological is for tansy? It's a little.
Warm.
Little warm, cinnabar warm.
So far this current biennium, there have been 156 releases of biological control agents, and 135 sites were being monitored for establishment or efficacy. I think it's important to note, while the funding is, we are able to have funding for the survey work, that if eradication does come become necessary, we do need additional resources to actually carry out the eradication effort, either coming back to the legislature or through the emergency board. And we currently have two pending eradication proposals, which we will talk about in greater detail. The one thing on this, the scanning electron microscopy, which I think is really interesting, and you see the little bug up there.
Technical term.
I need to be careful. It's a cinnabar caterpillar, not a worm.
Thank you.
There we go.
And really what it does is it allows us to really get greater detail, and what I'm told used to could take months in just 24 hours to really help identify if it is, in fact, an invasive species or not. So I think that picture just is really interesting because you can really get into the minute level of detail and coloring and, you know, little things. So the program area before was market access, which I talked about, and we do a number of inspection and certifications as well in the nursery and Christmas tree industries. It's about protecting market access, both domestically, because we've got requirements to ship these products to other states, but also internationally. I think, again, this is an example of the industry ODA trying to be nimble and adapt to industry needs. The best practices, management practices for Christmas tree export is one example. The Threatened and Endangered Plant Protection Program is one of our smallest programs, or is the smallest program we operate in our agency, and it has been a big challenge in terms of sustainable funding for the department. Not really having enough money has been hard for us to really have our core mission. We are operating solely really on grant funding today, and that's usually targeted to specific program work. But really core to the program is to protect native, threatened, and endangered plants on public lands, and that's been a challenge. The next up is the Natural Resource Program Area. This is the largest program area we have, and it's certainly grown over time. I am told it dominates the director's office, and I can tell you after 5 short weeks on the job, I have found that to be true. We do have strategic partners with other governmental bodies around the environmental protection piece, whether it's DEQ, Natural Resources, ODF&W, OWEB, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, Watershed Enhancement Boards. There's a whole host of people we work with under this program area. Couple of the program area goals I would just highlight. We obviously have the Ag Water Quality Program, which is the dominant program under this program area. It's been around for around 20 years, and we spend a lot of time focusing on this, and it's, you know, ever evolving, and certainly over the past 5 years has. We also have the Smoke Management Program, which we administer fire field burning in the Willamette Valley. You know, we coordinate, register burn permits. We will be on the ground surveillance during burning activities. We monitor the acreage burned. We collect fees. Those are just a few things that we do under the Smoke Management Program. We also, under the Natural Resource Program, is the pesticides program, the fertilizer program, And we also work on land use issues, that urban-rural kind of tension that can be there sometimes, but really trying to keep prime agricultural land in farm production. And then finally, this program area works on the demands for water quantity. And I'm actually going to turn it over to Lisa to talk a little bit about the water quality and water quantity pieces.
Thank you, Director Taylor. So Oregon's agricultural water quality is unique in the nation. Many states have programs that are to prevent pollution from agricultural activities, and they're typically called an Ag Practices Act. And those are, I think of them as a check system. You have X buffer, check. You do Y activity, check. Oregon's program is significantly different in that we base it on conditions. We, by rule, have a set of conditions that are required for ag producers to prevent runoff, to provide filtration, stream bank stability, and shade. And so it's really to make sure those functions that are necessary to enhance water and water quality are there. It's challenging, and more challenging, I think, in many ways than having an Ag Practices Act with a checkbox, because in many cases, it depends. But the beauty of Oregon's program is that with the diversity in our state, it allows it to adapt to grower needs and to the diverse crop types that we have here, as well as the differences across the state in terms of climate and topography. As Director Taylor said, the program has been in existence for about 20 years. The first years were implementation years when the area rules and plans were put in place. And then it became a program that was implemented around a complaint-based system. And then about 5 years ago, there really was a lot of focus and scrutiny coming into the program to say, what have you really done? We work very closely with Oregon's 45 soil and water conservation districts. They are the boots on the ground for this program. They provide the technical assistance. And then also with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, who provides a lot of funding for activities. As I said, 5 years ago, the focus began to change, and there was a need to really look at strategically what's happening with the program and what's happening on agricultural lands. And we began a process that we're in the third year of, and I can pause for you.
Would you pause, please, for just a second? Representative Helm.
And it may be that you're getting to my answer. But of the 45 soil and water conservation districts, do you happen to know how many of those have a rate base or a tax base? Because we just approved out in Washington County, and I was very excited to be part of helping get it passed. We finally have a permanent tax base to support the work of those folks that didn't have it before. What's the scene across the state as far as that goes?
So, fact check from the back of the room. 11 is what Dr. Jandel is telling me.
11 have a permanent tax base.
Yeah. And so the other ones, there is money provided by the state through OWEB to help fund those activities.
But they could, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, follow.
Oh, go ahead, follow.
Seems like we could do more if we had other money coming in to them to match and or complement the state money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, I think if you talk to any of the districts, they would agree with you very strongly.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. So today, as we've moved, this program has grown. We've taken on what we call a strategic focus. And that's made up of two different programs. One would be ODA's strategic implementation areas. Those are a regulatory-based program administered through ODA. And then a complementary system that's administered through the soil and water conservation districts called focus areas. And really what they're doing is going into small watersheds and doing a geographic analysis of riparian areas along water and looking at what's there, what should be there, and beginning to catalog that. In the case of strategic implementation areas, the regulatory piece for ODA, when we go in and we find places that need to have work done, we make contact with all of the landowners. We hold town halls. And from that, what we found is people go, where's my place and what does it look like and where am I at on the compliance realm. And we've been able to do work to move those along from areas that had concern to areas that had less concern. One of the challenges we really have with this program is changes in land ownership. It doesn't take long for something that looks good today to have issues tomorrow. It can relate to grazing. It can relate to runoff in these big winter storms that we've seen recently with bare ground. So the program continues to evolve. We're in the third year of our strategic implementation areas and continuing to learn and grow with them. We still have the complaint-based part of the program as well to respond to concerns that come to us from citizens and other landowners. Another major program within the natural resources area is our confined animal feeding operation program, commonly known as a CAFO at the state level and a CAFO at the federal level. And it really is another program that's about pollution control and keeping animal waste out of waterways. Oregon has program is very protective. It's protective of surface water as well as groundwater. Many of our operations are on a general permit under the NPDES, a federal permit, as well as we recently added a state permit as well for some different sizes to accommodate the needs of the industry. Our largest facilities are on individual NPDES permits in this program. The majority of our permittees would be dairies here as well. We keep our CAFOs, I like the state term, it's easier, animals, not animals, on a 10-month rotational cycle. And that's so that we're in the facilities at different times of the year. You don't always want to visit the same facility during the dry season, and you want to see them during the wet season so that you can make sure that they have all the adequate protections in place and are following the animal waste management plans that they have that are individual to each operation. Another program, I think it was two biennia ago, the legislature funded a water quantity position within our natural resource program. And this is a position that works very closely with Oregon Water Resources Department to assure adequate water for agricultural uses. Our pesticide program is one that I think over the last several sessions, the legislature has heard a lot about. We've had several high profile cases. Within this program, we register about 12,000 pesticide products annually, and we license about 13,000 applicators, operators, and pesticide dealers. Within the pesticide program, we respond to complaints. We do routine compliance assistance where we go out and watch when applications are being made to help people in terms of that technical assistance and outreach piece, as well as routine records reviews and then retail inspections as well. We really focus this program again around technical assistance and education and outreach. That said, we use a very strong regulatory backstop when people have violated the law, and that sometimes ends up in issuance of civil penalties. During the 2015, it was a short session, yeah, during the 2015 session, there was a lot of discussion around pesticides. 2016 session, following a couple of the high-profile cases. And during that, we had six new positions added into our pesticide program. Those were other funded positions. Four of them were pesticide investigators. One was an additional compliance manager, and then a citizens advocate. In addition, it enhanced the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, provided funding for 24-hour response from the 211 hotline, and then again, added the citizen's advocate to help people work through the system so that if they have been affected and they have a case in the system, they have somebody who they can call to help them answer their questions and help them understand what's going on in the process. Our fertilizer program is much like our feeds program. It really is what's on the label is in the bag, and so it's a consumer protection program. It also looks for adulterants in feeds. Many of you know ODA has been a very strong advocate in terms of agricultural lands and keeping agricultural lands in agricultural production. Our board has taken strong positions around this. I think the easiest way to look at this, once agricultural lands are converted, they don't go back. And so we take very strong positions in protecting those high value soils and areas in which agriculture can continue to grow. And I think many of you have worked with Jim Johnson on our staff to help you work through issues whenever you have land use questions related to ag. And I will stop there and see if there are any questions related to the natural resources program area.
Any questions? I have a question. You've gone over a couple of things. What is your capacity in terms of the inspections, the inspectors, the folks who are doing the looking at the pesticide usage and looking at just getting out there to find out who's what noxious weeds or animals might be out there that we might be concerned about?
Chair Fredericks, so off of the top of my head, I don't know the number of inspectors by program, but I can surely bring that back to you tomorrow.
If you would, that'd be good.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And there was also, and you may be sitting back there as well, may want to speak to this, but we had a stink bug, a brown infestation of stink bugs as well. Is that still going on, and how are we dealing with that?
I'm going to ask Dr. Helmuth Rog to come up and just give you an update on that.
Thank you.
Clarity, Mr. Chair, was that a bug or a beetle?
It's a bug.
Thank you. It's a bug. Thank you.
Chair Frederick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Helmuth Rog. I'm the director of the Plant Protection and Conservation Programs area, and thank you for the question. It's a brown marmorated stink bug, not a beetle, it's a stink bug, like a true bug. And we've detected in 2004 in Portland, it has spread over the last 13 years now, pretty much across the state. Oregon Department of Agriculture is one of the three agencies in the country involved in the biocontrol approach to fight the brown marmorated stink bug. We can't control it otherwise, so we're using a parasitic wasp, a tiny little wasp that goes after the eggs. And we have found it now. We have it in our quarantine facility with Oregon State University in Corvallis, but we found it. It has been vectored here, or it came into Oregon by itself. So we are reproducing it currently, and we are working also with the federal government, with APHIS, on testing that parasitic wasp, and we hope maybe this year to release it into the wild and help control some of the problems. So the biocontrol will take another few years, and hopefully we will see some impact on the brown marmorated stink bug. It's going to be a big issue, but we have another one, that's the Japanese beetle that our director just mentioned. That will be also a big concern.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Our next program area is the Internal Services and Consumer Protection. I think one of the interesting things about this program area is it does a lot of things that touch people every day, but they don't even know ODA is doing those activities. Like its name says, it's about protecting consumers and ensuring that people are essentially getting what they actually pay for. The goal of this program area is to ensure accuracy, validity, uniformity, and competence in Oregon's commercial weighing system. The first two bullets on the slide really talk about a level playing field for businesses and then that consumer protection piece. The weights and measures program assures equity in trade and really fairness in the marketplace through kind of routine but also unannounced inspections throughout the year for any commercially used weighing or measuring device. A great example of this is in the grocery store, where we do a lot in grocery stores. The motor fuel quality program ensures that the 2.1 million gallons of motor fuel of gasoline or biodiesel sold annually meets the standards for quality and complies with Oregon's renewable fuel standard. The lab services touch a lot of what we do at ODA on the regulatory side, which we'll talk more about. But they also provide services for things like export certification, the interstate shipment of shellfish, on the sanitation program, just to name a few. We house also the state's metrology lab. We inspect any weighing and measuring device in the state. The grocery store example I just mentioned, when you oftentimes are in the produce aisle and you want to weigh a bag of apples to make sure it's a pound, we're ensuring that all those skates or scales in the state, in fact, 1 pound equals 1 pound all over. We are seeing growing requests for us to calibrate others' weighing and measuring devices. I think in the side of technology, we're seeing more and more requests there. Again, this is about you're actually getting what you pay for. And it's really vital. I think it's something Oregonians don't know we do, but it's really vital for the everyday Oregonians who are, you know, just living their life and making sure that they are getting what they think they're getting. Like I said, we also do motor fuel quality. We test motor fuels in the state to ensure that they are what they basically claim to be. So if you want to buy 92 octane, you're actually buying 92 octane. We do respond to customer complaints and questions regarding the biofuels in the state, the renewable fuel standard. We take a host of complaints, respond to those complaints, and also questions. On our regulatory lab services, this is really, I think, the backbone of ODA's regulatory work. They provide services to a lot of our other program areas, whether it's water quality, food safety, fertilizer, pesticides, shellfish. They do a lot of that back work. Just recently, we had to shut down part of the Dungeness crabbing along the coast, and this lab was working to quickly try and get the samples to test for increased levels at the time of domoic acid. And so this was that regulatory backbone that we were really relying on to ensure that when we had enough samples at a low enough domoic acid level that we could reopen so we could get the fishermen back out to doing their jobs. We recently, I think, again, this is an area where we have tried to be a nimble organization. We were experiencing a backlog in the laboratory side of things, so we shifted people's work days and actually went to a 6-day work week so we could be running in really more samples and more testing and make sure to kind of get rid of some of that backlog. So again, just one more example where we tried to evolve and change with the needs of the industry and that we serve. Our lab is also pretty unique that several foreign governments have recognized it. And so this really touches a lot of the export work that we do and ensuring you know, that we're testing for buyer requirements or country requirements and that whatever those standards are, companies could come to us, say, selling wine into Japan and they want to ensure there aren't sulfates in the red wine. They can come get their product tested, and then it just eases business for these companies selling into those export markets. Under this program area, we also have the egg-laying hens cage program. This was legislation from 2011 around cage sizes for poultry in the state, and there was a phase-in period for that. We really focused the phase-in on outreach, and education to our commercial poultry sector. And now we are moving to inspection on the farm in compliance with the statute, but then also the United Egg Producers UEP standards as well. Are there questions on the internal services and consumer protection side of the house?
Any questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At some point, will you be discussing the stress that's been put on your testing labs from the cannabis industry testing?
We could talk about that now.
Interrupt your flow, but
that would be fine.
The committee needs to understand that.
For the record, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Department of Ag. The cannabis work agency-wide, we're just now, I think, beginning to understand.
If I might back up a little for the people that aren't on my other committee and explain how you get involved in this.
Co-Chair Frederick, Representative Helm, thank you for that reminder. I've kind of lived and breathed it and forget those things.
Yeah.
The Oregon Department of Agriculture is really following the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the Oregon Health Authority for cannabis regulation in our state today. And what does that mean? They hold the regulatory authority for both the medical program and the recreational, but there are many programs that inherently you have to follow just to be a producer or a grower. Or a retailer. One of those examples is food safety. If you're going to sell a food safety product that has cannabis in it, you would need to have a food safety license from the Department of Agriculture. If you are concerned about, you have a farm and you need to follow the state's water laws, you have to have water rights or permission to use water to in order to grow those. And so we get involved with our food safety program, our waste and measures program, scales. Scales are important. The reason why they're important is you certainly don't, if you're a business, don't want to give your product away, especially something that is weighed to the gram. And on the same side, as a consumer, you want to make sure you're getting what you pay for. So we've licensed 1,680 some scales today in that area. And then on the pesticide front and the laboratory front, that has been the most challenging, I think, for our agency. And the reason why is there are not pesticides labeled for use on cannabis. And why is that? Because the federal laws do not recognize cannabis today because it is considered a Schedule I drug. And so as growers, they have experienced the same pest and disease issues that you would, that like anyone. And so this has been difficult for them, I think, particularly since they're not used to being regulated. And so on the pesticide area, I think we've had 68 growers as of 2 weeks ago fail their testing that is required through the Oregon Health Authority testing regime. And those failed tests, those are tests that have detected something on the Oregon Health Authority's action level list of not allowed active ingredients. Those have been referred to ODA for pesticide investigations. Normally, we would put those investigations through our normal process like we do any other ag, forestry, or any other complaint. It could be even a pesticide applicator who you've hired in your city to maybe work on your apartment building that you own for pest control, those kinds of things. But our normal process is to embargo that product or detain it. And then do a thorough investigation, which also includes our laboratory. I calculated on the back of my hand the other day and through some other work that had we done our normal process, we would be $1.5 million into laboratory testing for that. We recognized pretty early on that because we were seeing a failure rate that was about 30% failing those Oregon Health Authority tests, that we needed to come up with something temporarily in order to make sure that there was some awareness into our pesticide laws, because I really think a lot of folks just didn't know. We always say at our agency, the label is the law, and so you need to read the label. Well, that's a challenge for them when there's nothing labeled. So we created an allowable list. It's about 300 products. It has things on it that are mainly natural in substance, garlic oil. Garlic oil, if it is used for pest prevention, has to be registered as a pesticide product. So it has things like that. We can share that list with you. That's the list that we've encouraged folks to look at. That list contains products that do not have a food tolerance, so they are very considered very low risk. They can have a label that, what I'll say, is very generic in nature. You can, and this is an absurd example, but it works for me today. you can spray this product indoors on a green plant. I mean, it's very broad, would work on any green plant. And so we tried to narrow those lists to those kinds of things. There are 59, I believe, that are on the list that are not allowed. Those are traditional chemistries. Those are the ones that are being tested for, and those are the ones that are failing. At some point, we're going to have to move the cannabis growers back into our normal investigative process. That is where we will see the financial impact to our laboratory and our pesticide investigations as we move forward. But we did think interim-wise, it was important to spend a lot of our time on the compliance and the technical assistance part to the growers. I think we've done a pretty good job of that and have kept the Measure 91 committee informed as we've gone along about how we're doing there. But there is going to be a time which our agency is going to start to financially, I think, suffer. I will just give you an example. The food safety work and the weights and measures work for the scales. For every dollar that we get in revenue through a license fee, we're spending $3 in effort to get it. It's just because it's complicated a little bit. It's a new industry. We're having to spend more time to make sure that those businesses, I think, get off on the right foot. And frankly, that's been our focus. So I hope, Representative Helm, that helped you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I just wanted, that's very helpful, and I just wanted to the committee to understand that as we move closer to having a regulatory regime to support the cannabis industry, there are certain unintended consequences that are happening. This is one of them. Our testing on the cannabis side, those separate labs finding failing crops or batches, it's putting stress on the agricultural labs of the ODA that have traditionally not been subject to this type of pressure from any other crop. So I hope that we can be sensitive to their needs and requests around testing in their budget.
Good to know. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Frederick. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Chair Frederick. So actually going back a little bit earlier, when I'm dying to know how they stole the cattle and did you catch them? I just cannot leave without knowing. And then I have a more serious question, although I'm sure it was very serious for the cattle and the ranch owners.
So. Co-Chair
Frederick and Senator Taylor, I don't know in all three cases if we caught all three of them. Our success rate is quite high. I can give you an example, though, of one of those three cases because...
You don't have to give it too much. I'm just curious. How did they steal them?
I'm getting there.
Oh, okay.
if you can imagine a brand that is in the shape of an L... Okay, so it's L. It's in Washington. They took another brand and put another leg on it, so it looks like an upside-down T. They carefully took that brand and overlaid it over what was the L with the new leg. And so it looked like an entirely new brand. Through lots of efforts between the state of Washington and our staff and a complaint, they tracked that down and were able to prove that it had been branded over with a new brand and stolen.
Wow. Okay, just curious. Thank you. Just really interesting. Okay, now moving on to the other side, I wanted to go back to the food safety. So I represent Southeast Portland, and I have a Representative Power, the state rep for half the district I represent, and a lot of people really love food, lots of farmers markets, you know, these that you were kind of referring to. And it's interesting because there's just more and more questions about, as food comes in from other countries, about the how we really know if there's, be it a grape from I won't say any particular country, but or there's something that's packaged or canned or jarred. You know, what is this? What is the level? Is there a level playing field, or is it just inherently? Are we just safer? Is there certain countries? I mean, how do we know the food is safe, or does it make a difference if it's fresh versus canned and packaged? I imagine it does, but I just wonder if you could speak to that in general, and then the inspection process when it comes in through the port. So.
Chairman Frederick, Senator Taylor, thank you for members of the committee. Thank you for that question. So I would say that part of the reason why the Food Safety Modernization Act really came about was concerns from some incoming imports to the United States around our food. And FDA was trying to really move towards a more preventative type model than a reactionary type model than what they kind of had in the past. Mm-hmm. They do inspect. So there is a whole rules under FSMA will deal with food coming into the United States. So the federal government has a bifurcated food safety system. The U.S. Department of Agriculture regulates meat, poultry, processed eggs, and catfish, and FDA regulates essentially everything else. And so some of that logic around FSMA is about increased inspection on what is coming into the United States. They also, certain types of foods have higher risk categories and try to follow a risk-based model the way we do at ODA as well. And Stephanie has come here so she could talk a little bit more in detail. She's our program area director.
Yeah, I'm just really wanting to make, when I can go back to my constituents when they say, is this food safe here? Because there does seem to be more and more food in the grocery store that it's from other countries, and I'm not necessarily opposed to it. I just want to understand, make sure it's okay, but we have to be sensitive to time too, probably.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, no, I just, I'm good. So.
Okay, thank you. Yes, thank you.
My question is going back to the cannabis issue a little bit, and I'm one of those people that just don't think it's healthy, and the fact that we don't label, have you considered labeling that it may be harmful to your health, or because my concern is the state, by not putting a label on it, is leaving itself open for a huge lawsuit if it is proven to be not to be hazardous to your health.
Co-Chair Frederick, Senator Girard, the role that ODA plays related to cannabis and food safety is the sanitation pieces. The labeling and packaging part of that is the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and OHA. I know they've gone through some rules and quite an extensive labeling process. I don't know that warning is on the label. I can certainly go back and ask if they've considered that. My memory today tells me it's not in the way that you just described it. It's more about making sure that the THC content and some of those things are labeled, and then the dosing patterns or the quantities are important, I know also.
Thank you. Any other questions? Or you go right ahead into the next section?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next part is our administration and support services. This is really manages the leadership, I think, for the whole agency. It provides overall leadership, but also it's where all of our licensing and business services resides. We also deal with really kind of agency-wide support services like HR, IT, procurement, contracts, financial management, those types of things. And it also serves as a coordinating feature for cross-cutting agency work with some of our sister agencies such as DEQ, ODFNW, depending on the topic. The next slide really gets into some of that coordinating work. I think cannabis is a great example, since we've been talking about that a little bit. We brought in a program director to try and help coordinate cannabis within our agency, but also with the other agencies, DLCC, OHA, to make sure we're staying coordinated, not just internally in our agency, but across our sister agencies as well. And so that's housed in the director's office. We also spend a lot of time coordinating with natural resource other agencies. Obviously, we may have different ultimate environmental or program goals, but really try to work to make sure that what we're doing in, say, our water quality program, the goal isn't necessarily protecting fish habitat, but ODFNW, maybe there's a place that they overlap. And so maximizing the resources and trying to be coordinated so our resources are targeted while achieving our program goal, but maybe having downstream, no pun intended, benefits as well. And then we also administer the state's wolf compensation program, which is essentially a block grant to the counties. Were there any questions on that, on the administration and support services that we provide at ODA?
That actually gets you through all five areas.
That does. That gets us. Maybe we'll pause, and if there were other any other questions on some of the first program areas we talked about, whether they were the market or and certifications or any additional food safety questions.
Any questions?
Oh. Well, we are cooking with gas, as I would say.
We
are. In Iowa.
We have just a few minutes here before we need to break, and
yes, sir.
And we will be they'll be coming back tomorrow.
So. Yes, sir. Very good. So we'll turn it to.
So we're at a point where we would be talking about our agency performance measures and the agency performance report. Do you want me to start on that today, or do you want to start off with it tomorrow?
I'd rather that you start on it today because I have a feeling we're going to have more questions tomorrow.
Okay, then let's do that. So in your binders, back under tab 8 is our agency performance report. And what I would propose to do is just to run through all of our key performance measures with you and give you a sense of where we're at. We have some areas where we are meeting our targets. We have some areas where we are not meeting our targets, and I can talk you through some of the challenges around those. So key performance measure number one relates to our food safety program, and it looks at ensuring compliance with CDC's 10 risk factors. And this is much about keeping hot foods hot, cold foods cold, having adequate hand washing facilities, et cetera. In this area, we have a target of 95%. We're just under that at 93.2%. I think we have hope that with some of the findings from the Secretary of State's audit and being able to spend some more time focusing on the work with our licensees, we'll be able to move that back up so that we're hitting our target, but we're very close there.
Can you hold on just a second? Yes, yes, Senator?
Yeah, my question to you is, I've dealt with KPMs through, when I sat on education, and lots of times the KPM itself is not exactly the most accurate. So if you hit a KPM that you think is out of whack, will you please tell us and be honest enough to say that this is really not achievable? Here is the best results, because it's all in the assumptions of the KPM. So it doesn't. I have a problem just doing a carpet sort of thing with a KPM, and it can be the other way too, where hey, you're meeting the KPM, but you could do better. So I just kind of want to know where the department is as far as the actual KPM that we're evaluating as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, thank you for that. I would say within our agency, just broadly, it's very challenging to capture all of the work that we do in the limited number of KPMs we have here. Mm-hmm. I would also add that we have struggled over the years, and LFO staff, I think, would agree with this, especially around
our marketing and economic development performance measures. It's hard to find a measure that really captures what we're doing because there are so many outside factors and so many players involved in that. So I'll give you that kind of as
On the marketing, I have a suggestion. I think Oregon cows are just as happy or happier than California cows.
So on KPM number one, I think actually we would say this is generally a pretty good performance measure because it focuses on the risk factors that are implicated in terms of food safety. KPM number two looks at compliance with weighing and measuring devices as related to our inspections in weights and measures. And in this one, we are exceeding our target by just a little bit and have consistently for some time. And I think, you know, this is a program that's had stable funding and has a good technical assistance component to it. And I think that shows in terms of the results that we're getting with our work there. KPM number three relates to our insect pest prevention management program as well as our weed program. And it looks at keeping the top 10 worst invaders out of Oregon. And for the most part, we're doing an okay job here. Again, we actually hit our target this year. We've been just under the target previously, but these are the worst of the worst. And this one is a challenging one as well because it's very, very broad for, you know, two or three programs that have much more detail to them. But we base it on work that we do with the Oregon Invasive Species Council for putting that list together. KPM number four relates directly to our noxious weed program. And this looks at the percent of A and T weeds, and this is a list that we keep, and I'll explain that in just a second, that are successfully excluded from the state. So A weeds are weeds, they're the worst of the worst, and they're not known to occur, or they have limited distribution in Oregon, and we're going after them to get rid of them. T weeds are weeds that are established, but have concern and typically are concerned for some of the local weed control programs. And in this one, we are currently not meeting our target. We're under our target by about 6%. And there is a lot of weed work out there. And I think if you've been in the Natural Resource Committee recently, you've heard lots about invasives and noxious weeds. So I think this follows along with that. KPM number five relates to our threatened and endangered plant program. It's a percent of listed threatened and endangered plants with stable or increasing populations as a result of the department's work and recovery efforts. We are actually exceeding our target in this area. This is a program I think Director Taylor spoke to just briefly. It has been a challenge for this program in that its funding has fluctuated over the last 10 years, or at least my life, with the department. It's had general fund, it's had lottery funds, it's had only federal funds, it's had money to go out and hunt for contracts to get work done. And so it is a challenge, but it focuses on those plants on public lands. A couple of great success stories here. There was a grant that the Klamath Falls Airport had to expand their runway several years ago. There was a threatened and endangered plant called milkvetch that was on that property. We worked with them to mitigate the impacts of moving those plants so that they could get the grant and do that expansion work. So there's not only an environmental piece to this program, but the potential for an economic piece. And we do a lot of work with ODOT as well. KPM number six is the percentage of our pesticide investigations that result in enforcement action. This one's a funny one because for us, we believe if we're successful when we don't have to issue civil penalties. And so if we get to the point of issuing civil penalties, something in our process hasn't worked. The technical assistance, the education for licensing, any number of other things. And so currently we are actually running below the target level of 25%. Don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but it's a hard performance measure in terms of what's the right way to measure that other than to just count civil penalties or regulatory actions issued. Mm. And you'll notice there was a spike in 2015. That was during the time where we had several very high profile pesticide investigations. And 2016 and beyond, we hope to see that number to stay stable or below because we've added additional resources into that program for more work and hopefully more preventative work. KPM number 7 relates to those certification programs that Director Taylor spoke to. And the purpose of this is to try and have our certifications completed within 15 days, business days, from those inspections. And there are, for some of our inspection types, we're meeting that goal, and for some of the more complicated ones, we aren't currently, so we are not meeting our target. One of the things that we are looking to do in this area to try and help improve our performance is some more cross-functional work with our programs. And we're doing training currently between our program inspectors in our commodities program and our nursery inspectors, and trying to add some of those nursery inspectors to do some of the inspections during their lower inspection time to give us a little more capacity there, and hopefully that'll help us move along in terms of improving that performance and turnaround time. So Chair Frederick, Senator Strawn, now we're to the ones that are the tough ones. And these are the ones related to economic development. The data typically lags us, and so we're about a year behind in terms of being able to capture it and report it. But the first one, KPM number 8, is sales as a result of trade activities with Oregon producers and processors. You'll notice that we are not meeting our target in 2015. There are several reasons that we look to being part of that. We had the port slowdown in Portland. The dollar has been strong. And then there have been just increased transportation challenges generally in terms of moving product to market. And so multiple reasons that could play into this, but we can't point to one of them to say, oh, this is exactly what's happened. But again, one of the more challenging ones, and so we have worked with LFO staff multiple times to try and revise and modify to come up with something that is representative of those economic development activities.
Hold on just a second. I'm trying to find. I don't think it's on OLIS, so we're going to have to get it on OLIS if you
yes,
want.
I just have the summary like you do.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, it's in the binders.
Yeah. No, we don't have binders.
We don't have binders, only electronic versions, and that's why you deliver two binders to us only. So we'll get it. Don't worry about it.
We'd like to have it if we could look through these, because as you're going over these things, good explanations that you're giving, that's helpful, but we don't have anything to refer to here.
We will get you a hard copy of those or get it out for you so that you can look at the graphs and charts. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. KPM number 9 relates to agricultural employment and the number of jobs saved or created as a result of activities to retain or expand Oregon agricultural and food processing capacity. It's measured by the number of jobs based on a telephone survey and email surveys to companies that we've assisted. And so again, this is one of those, it's variable in terms of the results with our mechanism for being able to capture the data. And again, this is one where we are not currently meeting our target as well. KPM number 10 relates to the confined animal feeding operations program, and it's the percent of permitted operations that are in compliance with their permit during their annual inspections. This is a performance measure where we are actually exceeding our target. The target is 90%, and in 2016, our rate of compliance was 97.2.
Excuse me, but how many places are you having to inspect with that, and what are they primarily? Are they a dairy primarily, feedlots? I don't know, chickens, I mean poultry?
There's approximately 520 or so.
So I'm hearing from the back of the room there, 520 or so.
Yeah.
All right, so, that's good to know.
Yeah. Chair Frederick, so Dr. Jandel confirmed the number, 520 or so. Dairies are our main customer in this program, but chicken facilities, mink facilities, beef feedlots, and finishing operations. So there's a broad spectrum. If an operator has animals in confinement with a wet waste system or confinement for a certain number of days, they're required to get a permit in Oregon to operate.
You know, I'm going to have to say it's now 2:30, 2:31. So I'm going to have to ask you to come back tomorrow and continue the presentation. Appreciate it. Just so that you know, we will have another day of the department giving presentation, and we'll have one day of public testimony. So I'm going to close this particular public hearing on right now and the committee meeting, and adjourn it until tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow.